guys. It's a Herculean task, but we do it with great pleasure. As happens every year, we jurors were presented with a mind-boggling variety of good writing to choose among for tonight's award. California is a special state, as large and powerful as many an international sovereignty, characterized by a unique topography and environment which brings us both joy and sorrow. Today, we are confronted by a mega drought and its discontents. How will we face this situation? Well, there is true grit on offer in pretty much all of the stories we're honoring tonight. We have a novel in which a Lebanese woman makes an otherwise desiccated existence rich and beautiful through literature. A coming-of-age triumph against pretty much every odd, a nuanced journey alongside the transformative Cesar Chavez, the profound ordeal of 33 Chilean miners, and the percolating rise and frothy reign of the sui generis, Malcolm Margolin, whose Heyday Books has for 40 years helped define and redefine what we think of as California. It's kind of a special Heyday night tonight. In addition to tonight's winners, I highly recommend you take a look at the finalists we agonized over, because all of them are exceptional books and offer even more pleasure than that on our plates tonight. And then a few more acknowledgments. I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club team who helped pull this annual project together, Renee Miguel, our queen, Renee did the heavy lifting, Alex Hernandez and Jennifer Haberman, who have coordinated the hundreds of book submissions from the deep pool of California writers, Tara Crane, very lovely Tara Crane, from the club's development team, and Mellon O'Keefe, who is our indomitable program producer. We are very grateful to our loyal program sponsor, the Bank of the West. So without further ado, please welcome Paul Weibel, head of the National Finance Group for Bank of the West.
Thank you, Mary Ellen. This, I believe, is the fifth year that I've stood before you to honor all of the readers and all of the writers in particular for their dedication to their craft. Bank of the West is proud to be a sponsor of this tonight. I think that the most important thing I can say is you would be surprised at how hard Bank of the West works to support literacy. There's never enough money, but we try our very best and believe very strongly that literacy is the key to progress in so many different things. You would think we would be very biased towards financial literacy, and we are. But we also, because we believe that type of skill is a life skill that everyone needs. But through our support of the Commonwealth Club and the Book Club Awards, our support of raising a reader, our support of reading partners, all of those things we believe will lead to more success, greater society improvement, and all the benefits that come from reading. The books tonight, as Mary Ellen described, are journeys into areas that perhaps we don't spend enough time thinking about. I'm so very excited to be here tonight and hear from the authors themselves and to celebrate their success. Thank you very much.
Good evening, everybody. I am Oscar Villalon, a member of the fiction jury, along with Catherine Ma and Peter Fish. I'm here to present the Commonwealth Club's first fiction awards. Our winner for the Commonwealth Club's silver medal in first fiction is Molly Antipole's The Un-Americans, a rich collection of stories spanning from Israel to California, from our contemporary times to the era of the Red Scare. The Un-Americans presents us with protagonists whose lives are profoundly affected by certain ideals and values, whether held by them personally or simply inherited. The Un-Americans makes us further aware of the varieties of what we might call the American story. Would you please give a congratulations to Molly Antipole, Silver Medalist in Fiction.
Thank you so much, Oscar. It's hard to explain how good it feels when, after years alone in a room writing, some of the top people in your field announced that what you were doing in there all that time mattered. And I will never forget the day that I heard about the California Book Award and how much I celebrated, and I'm still just completely thrilled. And so I'd like to begin by offering my tremendous thanks to the Commonwealth Club, Bank of the West, and everyone at the California Book Awards for believing in my book and for being so supportive of my stories. Thank you to my editor, the wise and wonderful Jill Bialoski, my loyal and compassionate agent, Bill Clegg, my outstanding publicist, Erin Sineski-Lovett, the always fantastic Bill Rusin, and everyone else at Norton and the Clegg Agency. I just feel so grateful to be a part of such an extraordinary team of people. And thank you to the jury for taking precious time away from their own work to consider mine. I appreciate it immensely. I am truly honored. To have my book recognized in this way is incredibly meaningful and inspiring, not to mention having my book in Christina's company, and also just like in San Francisco and in my own community. So thank you so much.
I'd like to now present our winner for the Commonwealth Club's Gold Medal in Fiction, who is Christina Nichols for Waiting for the Electricity. In post-Soviet Georgia, maritime lawyer Slims Ahmed Makashvili, I think that's right, deals with corruption and disorder and general indifference to both until a contest sponsored by Senator Hillary Clinton lands him an internship in San Francisco. An uproarious comic novel, Waiting for the Electricity, is satire of the First Order. Would you please give a warm congratulations to Christina Nichols, gold medalist in First Fiction.
This is such an honor, especially because my press is so small. I actually only thought about 11 people were going to read it. That was including my family. But for a debut novelist to actually be able to touch people out in the world is just so gratifying, especially because I didn't really think it would quite touch a Western audience because it was such a love song to Georgia, the country. And it was really just a kind of way that I was dealing with my own culture shock after living in Georgia. And I came back and was trying to figure out if really a country like that had existed, where they were trying to reinvent their personality or their identity after the Soviet collapse, and they were seeking the 12th century to do that. And so all the men had these sort of the Robin Hood complexes where they would hold up trains and steal from the men to give to the women. And I just thought, is that really possible? Did they really do that? And so this, and in this sort of strange land where they were the richest republic during Soviet times, and all the farmers were rich from tea and roses, they could just take subsidized flights to Moscow and sell roses for a ruble apiece at the ice skating rink and then become really rich and build big houses and spend the rest of the time being able to sing and dance and make toasts. And I just thought, this is my ideal country. People actually, all they cared about was art. I mean, it's also a little dysfunctional for that reason, too. So I came back, and this character just sort of lived with me because I missed Georgia so much. And so I got this voice in my head of this man who said, "My name is Slim Zakhmed, and I live in the 12th century." And from then on, he just sort of wrote it to the point that my roommate would put an extra table, an extra plate at the table for him. And at one point, my character was having kind of a hard time, so he called his mom and said, "We have this new roommate from Georgia." And she said, "Well, I'll have my church group pray for him." And his life actually improved after that. So essentially, I was trying to write this thing. I mean, the Western novel is so much about the exploration of the modern self. And so I just wanted to explore what it means when the self is still so identified with the community. But when you actually try to write a novel like that, when you get to about page 800 with no ending in sight, you realize why there's kind of a main character in most Western novels. The thing that moved me so much was that these people basically sat around waiting for electricity, which also doesn't really make a very exciting plot, except that all of the life that actually does arise while people are waiting, when people are living in a kind of surrenderance, and then are therefore tap into a kind of inner grace and joy. So I read this quote, actually, by Rebecca West in this memoir about the Balkans recently. And she says, "It's strange that there are spectacles which make us shiver with pleasure of a quite refined and intricate sort, and yet do not open any good avenues along which our minds, which are like old soldiers and like to march because that is their business, can travel. And listen, I will tell you, it is very sad, for we need new avenues." So I do believe that literature can show us those new avenues and new ways to be human. So thank you for honoring this book as such a possible avenue.
Good evening. I'm Peter Fish, and I'm here to present the Commonwealth Club's Fiction Awards. Speaking for the fiction jury, Oscar Villalon, Catherine Ma, and myself, I want to say that the task of reading so many contemporary California fiction writers was almost entirely pure pleasure. In fact, the only unpleasurable thing about it was lugging the heavy bags of books to and from the Commonwealth Club to the Union Square garage. This year, our fiction finalists were marked by an extraordinary combination of literary elegance, intellectual ambition, and emotional power. These books challenged our minds and comforted and broke our hearts. Our winner for the Commonwealth Club's Silver Medal in Fiction is Richard Powers' Orfeo, a novel. Echoing the Greek myth of Orpheus, Orfeo traces the career of a contemporary American composer, from his boyhood days in the Midwest to hard-won but tenuous success in academia and in concert halls, to a harrowing final journey across an increasingly paranoid America. Orfeo makes us truly grasp that the act of creating music is one of humankind's highest callings, even if it comes at immense personal cost. Many congratulations to Richard Powers, Silver Medalist in Fiction. Accepting on behalf of Richard, who is not in California at the moment, is Joe Murphy, the West Coast representative from his publisher, W.W. Norton and Company.
Hello. I'm very pleased to accept this from Mr. Powers, and he sent along some remarks. The composer, Harry Partch, whose hobo wanderings through California during the Depression were the first seed for Orfeo, once wrote, "The composer yearns for the streaking shades of sunset. He gets red. He longs for geranium and gets red. He dreams of tomato, but he gets red. He doesn't want red at all, but he gets red and is presumed to like it." The writer's life, too, is filled with shortfall. We want so much more than we ever succeed in making. But now and then there comes the occasional moment, like this one, when all that shortfall is paid in full. My heartfelt thanks to the judges of the California Book Awards and to the Commonwealth Club for finding in my little patch of red the hint of sunset.
Our winner for the Commonwealth Club's gold medal in fiction is Rabi Alameddine's An Unnecessary Woman. In once glamorous but now war-torn, brutalized Beirut, a translator looks back on a life shaped by great works of literature, but also by a fractious and disapproving family and by deep but doomed loves and friendships. Above all, this novel is testimony to the power of storytelling. The voice of its narrator, Alia, is so wry, funny, melancholy, pragmatic, and passionate. By the book's end, you realize that far from being unnecessary, she is unforgettable. Many congratulations to Rabi Alameddine, gold medalist in fiction.
Thank you so much. The usual thank yous, except it's unusual for me because I hardly ever win. Thank you to the jury for selecting it. I'm flattered. Thank you for the Commonwealth for having me. Thanks to my publisher and all that. But what I really would like to thank is independent bookstores. I would not be where I am today without independent bookstores. I'm not the type of writer. I am not the type of writer who sells well on Amazon. I'm hardly ever recognized. If this book was not picked up by booksellers who loved it and hand-sold it to every single person, I would have no career without them. I thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Challenged. Hi, good evening. I'm Rosalind Chang, along with Grace Ruth. We are the part of the committee that looks at both juvenile and young adult awards, and I will be giving out both awards today. The challenge of selecting a winner in the juvenile category lies in the wide range of eligible books, from books written for babies to those who can read and enjoy and be enjoyed by 10-year-olds. They cover all categories for this year. There were picture stories, poetry, biography, nonfiction, and text-based fictional stories for the upper ages. Fellow jurist Grace Ruth read all the juvenile entries and selected 5 finalists. They included a delightful lyrical picture story about a rescue dog who loves to eat shoes, a picture book biography of Carl Sagan, the true story of an elephant seal who preferred living in a river in Christchurch, New Zealand, to life in the ocean, and a futuristic mystery for older children that is set in the colony on the moon. This year's gold medalist is Jennifer L. Holm, author of The 14th Goldfish, published by Random House Children's Books. A 6th grader named Ellie narrates the story of her transition to middle school, life with divorced parents, and finally, the upheaval of having her estranged scientist grandfather show up. Grandpa Melvin has discovered a way of reversing aging, so when he moves in with her mother and her, he is a 13-year-old in appearance, but a quirky old man at the same time. Annie begins to attend her school. Told with good humor, this well-paced contemporary story has much to say about life, friendships, possibilities, and the love of science. Congratulations to Jennifer Holm, the gold medal winner in juvenile literature for The 14th Goldfish.
Tell I write for kids. I'm the only one that's not wearing black in this room. I was born in San Diego. My father is in the Navy, so he didn't stay here long, and I mostly grew up in Pennsylvania. I moved back to California in 2009 as a grown-up to Foster City with my husband and two young kids, and that was a rough year. My own father had recently died, and I was overwhelmed with small children and a big move from the East Coast. But there was something so magical about California, a sense of possibility that anything could happen here. And I started writing this book a few months later. The 14th Goldfish is a book that could only take place in California, in the shadow of San Francisco. It's about a girl whose scientist grandfather finds a cure to reverse aging and turns himself into a 13-year-old. Together, our young protagonist, Ellie, and Grandpa Melvin learn about life and death, about middle school and friendship, about Jonas Salk and Robert Oppenheimer, about school lunches and Coco Van, and they learn to believe in the possible, just like I did. Thank you.
And now for the Young Adult Award. The five finalists in the Young Adult category vary in literary genre, ranging from science fiction to fantasy to realism. Although each title's main character faces a different set of problems and handle adversity in his or her own way, the underlying theme of all five books is coming of age. The transition from childhood to adulthood is arguably the most important theme in young adult literature. This year's gold medalist is Isabel Quintero for Gabby, A Girl in Pieces, published by Cinco Puntos Press. Through her journal, poetry, and even a zine, the reader comes to know senior high school student Gabby Hernandez and her conflicts both at home and in her social life. Gabby struggles with body image and pressures to accept traditional values from her Mexican heritage. She desires to reconnect with her absent drug-addicted father, wants to support her best friends through their own trials, and longs to leave home for college. Her voice is bilingual and bicultural, funny, sarcastic, wistful, raw, and at times brutally honest. In her first novel, Ms. Quintero has created a protagonist who is very, very real. Gabby's experiences are authentically teen. Her strong voice rings true. Congratulations to Isabel Quintero, the gold medal winner in young adult literature for Gabby, A Girl in Pieces.
So, hello. I'm feeling a little more nervous than I thought I would. So first, I'd like to say thank you to Cinco Puntos Press, my publisher, and to the Commonwealth Club for selecting Gabby for this great honor. I'd also like to thank, are there any librarians in the audience? I'm guessing there are librarians. A few librarians. Those librarians, the librarians have really had my back from the beginning at times when I've gotten some not nice reviews, and librarians always have my back, so I've appreciated them. I was born and raised in the Inland Empire of Southern California, and that is about 40 minutes from LA, south of LA, in an area very similar to Gabby's hometown. But my parents are from Mexico. As such, my American experience, the experience of the daughter of two former undocumented immigrants with not even elementary education, is one that is not often celebrated in literature, or at least not in literature that is celebrated on bestseller list. There are great authors out there writing about these experiences. The late, great Michelle Cedos, who was from Oxnard, Juan Felipe Herrera, Meg Medina, and others. But their books are rarely put into the hands of young people, people looking for themselves but coming up empty-handed. Or if they do, they get a story about their Latino or Latina American experience, and it's often a tired narrative or some sort of stereotype. My goal was to write a book in which many young people, many young Americans, could see their realities and not feel alone. Since the book has come out, I've gotten so many messages from readers telling me that for the first time, they've seen themselves in a book, and that they realize that they're not alone. It's amazing what can happen when you feel your experience is validated. Look at what happened to me after reading Michelle Cedos's Chicana Falsa. Without reading that great book, I may not have found the courage to write as honestly as I did with Gabby and as I have in my poetry. So each time I get an email or a tweet or a Facebook message, I feel honored that Gabby has meant that much to someone. And that validates my writing. And it also gives me hope that someday, maybe that reader will pick up a pen and attempt to create their own reality, creating their reality and creating change. And thus writing all our varied experiences into existence and into a new American consciousness. Thank you.
I don't know, I'm challenged some kind of way. So this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and tonight we are celebrating the 84th annual California Book Awards with the winning authors. You can catch us on Facebook and Twitter and hear Commonwealth Club programs on the radio and on our YouTube channel. So my name's Sarah Rosenthal, and with Justin Chin and Dean Rader, I'm one-third of the California Book Awards Poetry Posse. And we selected five finalists this year for the gold medal, and all five are listed in your program and strongly merit your attention. This year's gold medal goes to The Feel Trio by Fred Moten. Like jazz, this book bears witness to the history of Black and brown people's oppression and exclusion while simultaneously creating a utopic zone of liberation and inclusion. Melding the dictions of center and margin, formality and funk, seminar, sacrament, and street corner, this language riffs as freely as the music of master improvisers, even while scoring itself exquisitely on the page as a poem, inhabiting the spacious silence of the page, welcoming the reader's tough or tender gaze. like the referentiality of jazz and rap, like the inspired communion with the realm of spirit known as speaking in tongues. The Feel Trio fulfills its mission to be a stream tuner unfurled in tongues that won't belong in anybody's mouth. This book is at once sobering and ecstasy producing. Be like the speaker who calls himself Fred. I can wonder who I am, wake up beautiful, and know everything. Fred Moten has published several books of poetry and criticism. He's a professor of English at the University of California, Riverside. He's received numerous honors and awards, including recognition as one of 10 New American Poets by the Poetry Society of America. Congratulations to Fred Moten, the gold medal winner in poetry for the Feel Trio, published by Letter Machine Editions. So Fred couldn't be with us tonight, but his publisher, Joshua Marie Wilkinson, will accept the award on his behalf.
Hey, everybody. Thank you so much to the jurors and I'm sorry that Fred couldn't be here. This book has been really amazing to me. Talk about a small press. I love the big presses. I love the small presses. I run a really tiny press. We publish 2 books a year. You think I'm kidding? I'm not. This was one of our 2 books last year, and we were lucky enough to publish Fred's book, and he's become a friend over the course of doing this with him. So thank you for supporting Fred's work and the Feel Trio, and to Renee and everybody here for putting this all together. It's amazing. I also want to thank the love of my life, Lisa Wells, who's here with me tonight and who's managed to score some Valium from Charlie D'Ambrosio in Iowa City. So I feel fine. Thanks. This is a statement from Fred. He's in LA with his kids. I'm sorry I can't be there tonight to accept this honor, but I want to offer my sincere thanks to the Commonwealth Club. The Feel Trio is dedicated to William Corbett, who has not only been my great friend and mentor, but also an extraordinary poet, and more importantly, a great and dedicated servant of poetry. When Fred sent this to me, he said, you know, this is going to be hard for you to read because there's some embarrassing stuff about you. And I could say the same things about Joshua Marie Wilkinson, who published The Feel Trio and sent it out into the world with enthusiasm and love. I can't thank them enough, and I'm especially thankful to Josh for getting H.R. Hegnauer to design the book, which H.R. did so carefully and so beautifully. I will always think of this award as a way of sharing the wonderful company of Marilyn Chin, Judy Halebsky, Douglas Kearney, and Claudia Rankine, for whose work I am extremely thankful as well. The Feel Trio is all about the sharing of company. For me, it and everything comes from sharing company with my partner, Laura Harris, and our children, Lorenzo, whom I have to thank also for the cover of the book, and Julian. I can't thank them and all of you enough.
Hi, everybody. I'm Stephen Boyd Soum, the editor of Santa Clara Magazine and a member of the Book Awards nonfiction jury, along with Roy Eisenhart, Alden Mudge, and our jury chair, Mary Ellen Hannibal. Perhaps the most gripping true story that we read this year isn't a single story at all. It's 33 stories braided into one taut thread, a tale of miners trapped 2,000 feet underground in the San Jose mine in Chile. The mine was nearly as deep as the tallest building on Earth. Men had been digging for gold and copper there since 1889, carving a spider web of tunnels through the heart of the mountain. Vibrations and avalanches carried through the mountain when tons of rock fell. And the miners would say, the mine is weeping a lot. Hector Tobar has written a book of tears and terror, a tragedy that came crashing down when a single block of granite-like stone called diorite, as tall as a 45-story building, broke loose and fell through the layers of the mine. This is not a spoiler alert. The 2010 disaster was widely covered by the international media. Deep Down Dark is subtitled The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. You can see the movie later this year, but don't wait, because this is a riveting story with exhaustive reporting told by a writer at the top of his game, compelling and solid and true, speaking to the larger forces at play in geology and history and what we value most in our lives. A couple of chapter titles: Mario Sees the Devil, Yanni's Mistress Feels His Presence in Their Home, and a couple numbers. It was 17 days before people on the surface even knew the miners were alive. It was 69 days before those men saw the light of day. Congratulations to Hector Tobar, the silver medal winner in nonfiction for Deep Down Dark. Accepting on his behalf is Oscar Villon.
Hector obviously is not here tonight. He cannot be here. He had one last class to teach at the University of Oregon, where he now splits his time between LA and Eugene, where he's in the journalism department up there. And he, if you know Hector, you know how passionate he is about writing. And he basically does not want to miss that last class with his kids and go over with them what they've learned through the semester. It tells you the sort of person he is, the type of writer he is, how he's committed to his narratives. I know he poured a lot of time and work into Deep Down Dark. And for Hector, he's especially grateful for this prize because about 2 years ago, he received the gold medal in fiction for his novel, The Barbarian Nurseries. So to have the support, the continued support of the Commonwealth Club for this book, too, means a great deal to him. I will leave you with this. If Hector was here, he would have an incredible anecdote for you right now that would tie everything together. I'm sorry. All I could say is on behalf of Hector, thank you very much.
So here's a California story. In this case, tracing the arc of a man's life from farm laborer to civil rights leader and revered American hero, and beyond. As Miriam Powell stakes out in her biography of Cesar Chavez, he seared into the conscience of the nation the plight of farm workers. He built a powerful movement and the United Farm Workers Union. Great boycotts, strikes against growers, powerful tools that he employed. The back-breaking short-handled hoe, a tool that debilitated farm workers and he saw banned in 1975. He understood the power of myth-making, including the story of himself. He fasted, he marched, he took inspiration from Gandhi and Mao alike, sometimes to ruthless effect. He regularly purged the ranks of the UFW. In 1984, when he spoke to the Commonwealth Club of California, Cesar Chavez surmised, "Unions, like other institutions, can come and go." Indeed, by that point, the UFW had only one contract with a single grape grower. To write The Crusades of Cesar Chavez, Miriam Powell conducted scores of interviews and nearly a decade of research in papers and hundreds of tape recordings that Chavez made. What emerges in this biography is a changing portrait of a flawed and sometimes troubled man who pushed out rivals and led group shaming rituals. He remained as leader long after the spark seemed to have gone. But that's not to diminish the man's place in history. The fact is that he did live on, that he wasn't a 1960s martyr shot down in his prime. And as he said, when looking back at what the movement had accomplished. La causa, our cause, doesn't have to be experienced twice. Congratulations to Miriam Pobl, the gold medal winner in nonfiction for The Crusades of Caesar Chavez.
It's a good thing I wasn't planning a quote from the Commonwealth Club speech. So thank you so much to the jury and the Commonwealth Club. And this award, to win a California Book Award, is especially meaningful to me because California is my adopted home. I'm from New York. And in the 15 years since I moved here, I've come to care deeply about the state and to find both its past and present endlessly fascinating. And I feel, in a sense, deeply indebted to California, for it is here that I have found my place as a writer. I write to connect those two worlds, the past and the present. I strive to probe, understand, and narrate history in ways that may shape thoughts and actions now and into the future. Cesar Chavez died in 1993, but I rarely talk about this book without describing a much more recent scene. In 2005, I embarked on the path that ultimately led me to write this biography. I spent time talking to farm workers who lived in the canyons in San Diego, a stone's throw from some of the wealthiest zip codes in the country. They lived in makeshift cardboard shacks burrowed into hillsides with no running water. Their stark reality changed the trajectory of my life. As a journalist, I wanted to understand how those conditions had persisted decades after Cesar Chavez's success. What had become of his iconic movement? I set out to explore those questions, just to put the present in context, I thought, to write newspaper stories. And I did that. But the more I learned, the deeper I became drawn into the past, into a complicated, compelling, and untold story. So I forsook journalism for history and wrote my first book about the rise and fall of the farm worker movement, told through the eyes of 8 key participants. It was a way to make sense of an exhilarating and troubling time, to answer questions that had haunted many people for decades. And it was a narrative that helped explain why California farm workers still live and work in the conditions that they do. Along the way, I read more California history. I became friends with historians. I often quoted a favorite saying of one of them, "The historian is the hand that rectifies." And then I took on the challenge of becoming Cesar Chavez's biographer, because no one else had done it. And because in the absence of a biography, the reality of this remarkable life and accomplishments had faded away, replaced by a sort of fuzzy myth, and even the myth was rapidly vanishing. The challenge to me was more than just being the hand that rectified and setting the record straight. I was convinced that the history was more compelling than the mythology. By reducing Chavez to a one-dimensional saintly face on a postage stamp and a name on street signs, his story had lost its power. Almost no one knows who he is anymore, or what he had done, and why he's such a significant historic figure. And those lessons from his past, found in the handwritten reports that he laboriously wrote in the 1950s, in the letters he wrote in the 1960s, and in the tape recordings he made in the 1970s, are immensely relevant today. Many issues today are the very same ones that he took on when he first began organizing in communities around California, even before he founded the Farm Workers Union. The right to vote, the right to citizenship, the right to a decent education. Income equality today is the cause celebre. The labor movement is foundering. Political and legal protection for poor people becomes increasingly fragile, and even the definition of one man, one vote is now up for grabs. And in a time like this, I think Chavez's model of grassroots community organizing, his ability to empower people who felt powerless and disenfranchised, his success, even in the absence of laws or political power that protected workers, that's a model that needs to be studied and understood. So I'll end by tying the past to the present again. As you heard, Cesar Chavez gave a speech here 30 years ago to the Commonwealth Club. He was not a gifted speaker, but he made what arguably became his most famous speech. And I use the scene of that speech to open this biography, because it's a speech that embodied so much of what made him a brilliant visionary and a tragic hero. It was, in effect, a eulogy for his own movement, and he foresaw where his triumphs would be lasting and where they would prove frustratingly elusive. So it feels symbolically very meaningful to me to be here tonight. This award is an affirmation of the importance of capturing history in all of its complexity. So thank you for helping ensure that more people will find out who Cesar Chavez was and learn from his remarkable life and legacy. Thanks very much.
So we have two more awards left for the evening, and of course we're all a little bit inclined to doing double tasking, so I was looking at the number of big publishers that win tonight and the number of little publishers that won tonight, and little publishers outnumber big publishers tonight. Yay! And if you actually go to the finalists, it's even in the other direction. So these two awards both exemplify what a small press can do, as Heyday Books exemplifies what a small press can do. So our award in Californiana goes to Laura Ackley's San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915. That's a very long title for a very, very beautiful and beguiling book. This is a gorgeous book full of photographs, illustrations, and essays that bring the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition to life. Intended to advertise to the world the glorious resurrection of San Francisco after the 1906 earthquake, the exposition attempted to show everything, to tell everything, and to curate the planet. How interesting that today our virtual world picks up that ambition and runs with it, but online searching won't give you nearly the pleasures that are on offer in this glorious volume to be read and lingered over for many enjoyable hours. So to Laura Ackley, the gold medal in Californiana.
Is a gold medal. That's fantastic. Thank you so much to the California Book Awards, and especially its judges, for bestowing this honor upon my book, San Francisco's Jewel City, the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915, which I will shorten to the PPIE, both for brevity and sanity's sake. I'm extremely grateful to my co-publishers, Heyday, and the California Historical Society for allowing me to create the type of book that I had always imagined. Malcolm Margolin is sort of a magical being who has for decades pursued the conjuration of beauty from thin air. He's assembled a cohort also devoted to this goal, and editor Gail Wadawa, book designer Ashley Ingram, and art director Diane Lee, who are all here this evening, and so many others at Heyday, were absolutely critical to realizing a beautiful book. Archivists, librarians, and fellow collectors were also generous and instrumental. My co-publisher, CHS, has also done the amazing job of coordinating the hundreds of events celebrating this, the exposition's centennial year. So I was inspired to write this book because I care deeply about the entirety of the fair, not just a specific area. And it seemed that on every library shelf devoted to world's fairs, there was an empty space in exactly the shape of San Francisco's Jewel City. So my co-publishers enabled me to create the book that perfectly filled that empty space on all those bookshelves. Finally, my love and appreciation goes out to those in my family, without whom those shelves would still be empty. My parents, whom together have more than 70 years of professional writing and editing experience, went through the manuscript with their fine-toothed red pens at least 5 times, and the work is far, far better for it. Most importantly of all, my husband, Sandor Temme, to whom the book is dedicated, supported me both financially, which is very important, and encouraged me through every crisis of research and writing. I'm often asked, what possessed you to write this book? In my more flippant answers, I answer, hopeless naivete. But in reality, I was captivated by the Jewel City from the first time I saw a photo of the fantastic sculpted facades of the fair's midway, which featured buildings shaped like elephants, pagodas, castles, giants, and ice cream cones. I've been most intrigued by the very kaleidoscopic nature of the World's Fair. Beyond its huge size, palatial architecture, wondrous entertainment, and amazing rides, we can also discern all of the elements that made up the cultural landscape of 1915. The United States had not yet entered World War I, but the PPIE was suffused with its repercussions. The voices of Teddy Roosevelt and William Jennings Bryan each rang through the giant Court of the Universe in July, Bryan promoting pacifism and Roosevelt exhorting preparedness. And John Philip Sousa and his band played at their final World's Fair. Within the gates of the Jewel City, we could see not only beautiful artifacts, but the latest technology in movies, aviation, and automobiles. Yet, also on display were the state of the world in politics, race relations, gender, and science, some of which we now know to be totally wrong. The PPIE represented a striving by all involved to present the best the world had to offer. Further, the fact that the Jewel City opened less than 9 years after the great earthquake and fire bore testament to the amazing power of San Francisco, where many groups, some of whom do not always agree with one another, can pull together towards a magnificent goal. Writer Juliet James said in 1915 of that effort, quote, "And the pastel city by the sea will not leave us. For as the years go on, the vision of this dream city will float before us, leading us to finer and higher works." So though the PPIE was admittedly imperfect, it represents the grand aspiration and audacity that San Francisco and the Bay Area still exemplify. Thank you again to the Commonwealth Club and the California Book Awards for honoring me and my book with this wonderful gold medal. Thank you.
So just thinking about what I wanted to say about Malcolm Margolin tonight made me smile. I think just thinking about Malcolm makes everybody smile. About a year ago, I went over to Heyday Books in Berkeley to interview Malcolm for an article, and he told me some of the facts of his life about writing The Ohlone Way, about founding Heyday Books 40 years ago, not only because he liked writing books, but he liked making them too. And his books are very distinctively beautiful objects. You always want to own one of those Heyday Books books. Of his childhood, Malcolm said, stories were told and secrets were kept. Malcolm's stories and his voice are so wonderfully captured by Kim Bancroft in The Heyday of Malcolm Margolin that you can hear his voice at the kitchen table in Boston where he grew up, and you can practically feel yourself in that VW van as he and his wife made their Volkswagen as they came west toward the summer of love. Kim Bancroft, a fantastic job in conveying a personality, a place, a time, did a really great job. Malcolm Margolin's Heyday Books has won an outsized number of awards from the Commonwealth Club over the years. I was going to ask Renee to count them up, but I thought I wouldn't tax her with that at the last minute, because there's so many, really. Heyday often wins Californiana and often wins Contribution to Publishing. Perhaps more than any other person or institution over the past 40 years, Malcolm has amplified our sense of California in publishing environmentally focused books that appreciate our native flora and fauna, and most significantly, native Californian histories, biographies, and first-person testimonies. We are very lucky indeed to have our cultural life presided over by so benign and generous a spirit. So it is with great pleasure that the Commonwealth Club recognizes Kim Bancroft and Malcolm Margolin, and Malcolm, a man in and of himself, a great contribution to publishing indeed.
Thank you very much. I'm very moved to receive this. And thanks to the Commonwealth Club, I have listened to many voices that have inspired me, that have come and spoken to the Commonwealth Club over the years. So I can't believe that I get to be part of that. And that is in large part thanks to my friendship with Malcolm and to all the folks at Heyday who are the characters in this book. And I look out upon you. You have been part of this book. Who your voices inspired the stories, the people that have written for Heyday. There are 20 characters in this room who are in this book. And it is true that I started out, thanks to Sadie Margolin, having a friendship with Malcolm that allowed me to, over the years, get to work with Heyday and then to expand into the amazing opportunity of simply sitting with Malcolm and listening to his stories. And he said, hey, if you really want to understand what Heyday is about, you need to go out and talk to the people who work here, the people who fund us, the friends who've been on the board, the people who write for Heyday. And so many of you are part of this book. And I had the lucky opportunity of getting to take all of those interviews and tie them together. And I decided for this event to do another act of wonderful reduction and create a poem out of some of my favorite lines that Malcolm said that are throughout this book. So this is a poem for Malcolm and all of us at Heyday. And we affectionately call the book Hey Mal. Hey, Mal. People become part of Heyday by riding in on a sea of friendships, on a sea of shared passions. We like who we're becoming, being in love with the world, and our joy in doing something real. Look at the people in these books, little furnaces of passion and integrity. In the fight for the human imagination, truth and beauty are always just 10 minutes away. Heyday's job is to embrace all of that. Thank you.
Hey, listen, Malcolm couldn't be with you today. He's off in a world of daydreams and where he tends to live. I'm his publisher, Malcolm Margolin, and I'm standing in for him. So, hey, there's something. Heyday's been around for 41 years, and it's been 41 years of amazing struggle and wondering whether we're going to pay the rent and meet the payroll. And This is, and I've been afraid that the time would come when I would have to say these words. Friends, we're bankrupt. And it's not a bankruptcy of money, it's a bankruptcy of gratitude. I look at the people in this room, my debt of gratitude is so great that I'm never going to be able to pay it. And the number of people here that have helped us, that have been the authors, the funders, friends, and the debt of gratitude is so damn great that I've decided to thank nobody. And this is a very sad decision because it means that I can't thank Laura for entrusting how many years of work to us?
About a dozen years
of work to us. It means that I can't thank the California Historical Society for cooperating with us on this. It means that I can't thank Kim for telling me who I was, for showing me who I was. It means that I can't thank Kim's father, Pete, for being a wonderful editor and having the, this is the oddest friendship. My affection for Pete is so great. And it's like one of those children's books of the rhinoceros and the hedgehog or something. And I have no idea how this happened, Pete, but I absolutely adore you. And I can't begin to, it doesn't give me time to thank my wife, Rena, who founded Hey Day with me. And when I brought this book, since I don't have any time, I can't tell too many stories. So I can't tell the story of how when I first brought this manuscript home, she told me that I got it all wrong. And all these anecdotes, I put words in other people's mouths. And I changed what I could if it didn't wreck the story. I can't begin, I don't have time to thank Huey Johnson. Huey, are you here? Yeah, Huey Johnson over there. So Huey, back in 1972, I was working for East Bay Regional Park District, and I wanted some money to write a book. And Huey had some money from the Point Foundation, which the Whole Earth Catalog, which Stuart Brand had set up, and he gave me $2,000 to write a book. It took me 4 months to write this book, and I've never done anything like this in my whole life. But the $2,000 was heaven. And with that, I sold that book to Houghton Mifflin for $10,000. I founded Hey Day Books with it. And Huey has been an inspiration all of my life. Huey brought Nature Conservancy to California. He created trust for public land. He has resource renewal today. He was governor of Jerry Brown's in his cabinet. He was the first, he was Jerry Brown's minister resource, you head of the resource agency. And Huey was my inspiration in the old days. He's still my inspiration. Talk to Huey and find out what he's doing. He's absolutely magnificent. I can't begin to thank the Commonwealth. I'm not going to thank the Commonwealth Club. And I'm not going to mention how when, and I know what it is to do a book award. I was once a juror for Penn West. 75 books arrived that I had to read in a month and a half. It was nightmarish. The amount of work, and it was like a kid who likes ice cream that is suddenly given 3 barrels full of ice cream that he has to eat. It was horrendous. I don't have time to thank my board. I don't have time to thank Guy Lampard over there, who's ended up being such a gift to us that I'm not sure that we would have survived today if Guy hadn't been around. Is Rick Baum here? Listen. Rick is our finance. He's the head of our finance department. And I don't know what he did in a previous life that made him deserve, that got him this one. He must have been terrible in a previous life. But he runs these finance committee meetings. It's a combination of philosophy and poetry and finance and stand-up comedy. The last meeting we had, I presented this idea that was absolutely magnificent. It was well thought out. The numbers were lined up. It was a perfect proposition. And as Rick is listening to it, he says, "Why does the name Don Quixote come to mind?" And it was done with such affection. It was so marvelous. But there were plenty more windmills to tilt. There's so many other people around here that I can thank, but my staff, the other board members that are here, Lisa and Mike Trainer, and so many friends. Hey, listen, my friend Sonia Torres over there, the staff. You know, I've often said that I got into publishing to be independent, and I screwed up. I'm so totally dependent on everybody that it's just a marvel. And I'm really grateful for it. Let me just see when I'll get off this second. In a second. Yeah, that is the okay. I'll hit the gavel in another couple of minutes. So we're going through succession. I'll be handing over Heyday to somebody at the end of the year, and I'll still be around. I'll still be doing stuff, but it's time to hand this over to somebody. So we're having these marvelous discussions on what Heyday is all about, and is Heyday publisher? Are we looking for a publisher to run it? Are we looking for, is it a nonprofit? Are we looking for somebody that's into this cultural, intellectual, nonprofit world? I realized recently that it's neither one. I think it's a church. And I think that it runs on the principles. I think what we're doing is chasing beauty and getting beauty out into the world. And what we're, and it's the religion of, it's the old aesthetic religion of beauty, the beauty that's out in the world, the beauty that's within the people that work for us, the beauty of the books that come to us. And what we do is when things come in, this is where we live. And I'm not sure how to say this. So there's a wonderful quote by Franz Kafka, of all people. And the quote from Franz Kafka is, so we chase beauty, but as the pastor of this church, my spiritual practice is deep hanging out. And what I do is I hang out deeply in places. And Franz Kafka sums it up. He says, you do not need to leave your room, remain sitting at your table, and listen. You do not even have to listen. Simply wait. Be quiet, still, and solitary. The world will freely offer itself to you to be unmasked. It has no choice. It will roll in ecstasy at your feet. I think there's a kind of way of approaching the world with a porousness, with an openness, where you can see its beauty. And this is what we've done. I'm flattered at this praise, or flattered at this award. I'm flattered at all the applause I've been getting. But you know, and it's not as if I'm an inert lump and just hang around and wait for beauty to come to me. I'm out in the world. I'm creative. I'm intelligent. I'm opportunistic. But if what was here depended upon me, it would be a very small amount of stuff that would be out there. It would be paltry. What we've done is create a place where the inherent beauty of the world could come to us, where we could forge something that has integrity and has something in it that just breaks your heart because it's so lovely. And this is what Heyday does. There's one thing of great beauty that I would like to recommend. And it's something that's one of the most beautiful things anybody can do, and it's buy books. So I'm going to end this thing and go out and buy books.
I have to hit the gavel a little harder. Go out and buy books now. Next time, harder.